Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by Wired Tree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Hey man, did you defect? Did you get a haircut? I think we talked about it last week. Never mind.
Okay. Cut my own hair like a maverick. Justin Robert Young.
Hey friends, I did get a haircut and I paid good money for it and I don't care who knows it.
Yes. And Mr. Bryce Castillo.
Hey everybody, that's me. I still have not cut my hair.
Well, Bryce, if you need some tips, just let me know. We'll live stream it.
If you need some tips, I have them. I saved them over here. I can send them to you.
Yeah.
Those classic hair tips.
That'd be funny. Like, oh my God, one of us blindfolded while the other one's watching on video and we're trying to cut ourselves while the other person tells us what to do.
No, you're left.
It's a keep cutting and nobody will laugh. We promise.
Oh, geez. This is what things have resorted us to. Hey, so last week, Facebook had their Facebook, which used to be called Oculus Connect. Now it's like Facebook Connect, but it's still Oculus, which was where they did their presentation reveal of the brand new Oculus Quest 2 and showed some of the new initiatives that Facebook's working on. And I don't know if you've read the reviews for the hardware for Oculus Quest 2. Raves. You know, the Quest 2, they've dropped the price, the introductory price from $399 down to $299. They're using the latest Qualcomm Snapdragon processor, which means that it's way faster than the original. It's got 50% more pixels, which they're saying is effectively 2K per eye. And they did use a cloth strap, which some people say, most people say it's sort of a downgrade, but for $50 more, you can buy the Elite strap. So you can still get the brand new Quest with a much more pro level strap for still $50 cheaper than the original Quest. Of course, you have to have a Facebook account.
Yeah. That's
which weird, I mean, weirdly. even if you don't use it, you probably have it. It's just a matter of like, you know, like realizing, oh no, this is going to be a thing forever, isn't it? And that I'm always just going to have to be tied to this thing.
Yeah. So it's for some people, that's the deal breaker. And it's one of these things where you see these reviews of like, because I, from a hardware point of view, what you're getting for $299 is amazing. And I've heard, you know, people like, ah, no, I'm not going to do it. I'm like, I'm with you. Tell me the other headset. It's totally wireless in this level I should get. I'll pay a couple hundred bucks more, but there isn't. There's just nothing out there.
Yeah.
No.
Certainly
no, there's
for
not.
Right now, but of course it's also, I mean, I think all three of us would agree that it's inevitable that somebody steps into the space and joins the club, but you're right. For right now, they're the only player in town.
Yeah, there will be. It's just between, you know, the fun I could be having now.
Yeah.
You know, I love my Quest. I love being untethered. I love the Quest. I love not having to worry about cables or anything. I love the fact that it's self-contained. I love the fact that, you know, I've got multiple, that if I want to use one, my girlfriend can use hers. You know, that I just, that is a, one of the things I just like, is that it's not like you have to have, you know, in a house, you have to have more than one PC to be able to drive them. It just, part of the fun is you can have, you know, multiple in the house. The $299 price point is insane. I mean, the original Quest, when I got that, I thought what they put into it's great.
I think Justin and I bought in on the Vive when it was $899 and required a full PC to run it.
Yeah.
So I mean, $299 for a self-contained unit really is truly remarkable. I mean, think about like with that $500 of savings, you could buy, let me check my math. Yes. All of the good VR games, all of them. Yep. You could buy all of them.
Yeah.
Well, and what they've done now too is that we talked about this was coming up last week because the question was, the specs on the Quest 2 seemed too good to be true, because it meant like, well, what's going to happen to the Rift S? Because that's their tethered Oculus, you know, one plugging into your PC. And if the Quest was this good, like, why would anybody buy that? And the answer is, Facebook says, Nobody will. That's why we're going to discontinue it in a few months. And going forward, it's going to be the Quest 2. Then if you want to do PC games, plug into Steam or whatever else, you then just use your cable to your PC.
And then it offloads. I didn't know that you could. I know we had talked about it plugging into the PC, but I didn't know that it would play nice with Steam specifically.
Well, there are other. I gotta look to see, but there are there are many different ways to make it work.
I do know that Facebook has been spending a lot of money to pay people to make certain properties exclusive to Oculus at the expense of the Vive. But if they're now in a dominant position and they're willing to play nice with Steam, then that might be worth me reconsidering getting one of these.
Well, now, I think the biggest thing is
that $300, right? The biggest thing is $299, and you need to be $299 worth of Shure to be in the VR game. And that's the thing, is you had a lot of space over there that you've already dedicated to VR. So at a certain point, does that just make sense to have the ability to interact with it?
Yeah. But yeah, as far as there's been the ability to play, both, with Steam using Oculus Rift and Quest has been there for a while. So, that's going to see, I don't know how tightly that integration works, but, you can plug right into Steam VR.
Yeah. So. It sounds like the only thing that this wouldn't offer then is the Valve Index does have the Knuckles interface where you get individual, although I wonder if this has it just without even, no, I guess if you're holding a control.
No, I don't think you don't get individual fingers. Yeah.
And by the way, this is not a complaint. This is us being spoiled for choice. This is us.
Yeah.
This is in every way the best set of problems.
Quest has, which is great, is hand tracking.
Right. But that's just naked hands, right? So
bare naked hands, Brian. Bare naked hands. Yeah. There's going to be Stratus, but I think from a hardware point of view, Facebook is just throwing so much money and so much effort into this. And now the idea of get the Quest, get the cable, plug it into your PC, play PC games. It's kind of there was talk last year because when they announced the Quest, you internally at Facebook, you got the impression there was one camp that was PC gaming's the future because you'll never have the same experience on a mobile. And the other people yes, but mobile can go mass market. We can get more mobile devices into people's hands. And you knew somebody won an argument the day you went to go to Oculus and it defaulted to the Quest because they were always out of stock. They couldn't just the demand for outstrip whatever they thought the supply was going to be. And then now going forward, they're and for the foreseeable future, if you want to have a PC experience, just buy the Quest and plug it in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is a smart move on their part. I'll be really interested to see, I guess, this is future forwarding. It sounds like they're obviously the dominant player here and will continue to be so. I wonder if they're going to try to emulate any kind of finger articulation, but it sounds to me like they're just going to rely on the naked hands.
I think that it's you're going to see a style of game that will continue to take advantage of what that hardware does best. It's you're right, Brian. You might not see that gauntlet style, a finger articulation, but you're probably going to see games that have a move advantage, a physical mobility advantage that
run around your house and you're never going to it'll just replace every bit of your furniture and detritus on the floor with, goblin stones or whatever. And so you'll know to not trip over them.
Yeah.
Now, have you used this finger tracking, Brian, on the...
No, I tried to buy a Valve Index, but they were sold out when I... This is right after lockdown. But basically what it is you just have a strap so that you can fully open your hands and the controller still stays in your hand. And then it pays attention to each of your fingers. So,
do you think that's a killer feature for VR?
I think I really missed it when I was playing Half-Life Alyx, and I think it would have been a lot, a little more immersive for me to be able to, you know, to forgive me, give middle fingers, but also to close three of my fingers and use, one of them as a pointer finger to press buttons and all that stuff. So, it's not a hill I want to die on or anything, and it's not a there's such a temptation from grade school holdover where it's like, I'm Genesis, I'm Super Nintendo, and truthfully, I think we're all on team both, but I tend to see things in how they contrast as opposed to, you know.
Yeah, you know what? Just saying, on the Quest, what it has, and it's not the same, but they have, there's a sensor on the front button which tells if your finger's just lightly, if it's near it. And so you do get, for your finger thing, it's not the same as all the other fingers at all, but you still have, like, because I know, like, we use the Quest, it's easy to do, like, the one finger type. You just let go of the button, or when you bring your hip finger near. So there is some sensitivity there, but it's not all four fingers, you know, like the knuckles.
Yeah.
But I never, it's not a thing I ever think about, you know, again, because it's just... You spend enough time in that thing, and I think you just sort of, you know, it's like chopsticks. You just sort of get used to it.
Yeah, and that is important to note. It's like, you know, you don't miss what you don't have, you know. So it's like, you know, what you have with the Quest is complete freedom to use it anywhere, very, very easily. And so you tend to focus on that part.
Yeah, and I've been lucky to, like, try being in LA where you got a lot of VR stuff. I've tried a lot of experimental stuff and some, like, crazy stuff. Some of what I'm not under NDA on, you know, where, you know, like, entire, like, things you sit in that move you or give you motion simulation stuff and things like that. And it is crazy, too, because you see, like, there was a period of time where companies that you would never, like, entertainment, that were involved in entertainment tech that were getting into, like, VR stuff, that were trying stuff out. And I've seen a lot of, you know, the only time I ever had a thing that made me go, OMG, it's this or nothing, was when I got to use the Beta Vive, you mm-hmm. know, back when that was first, you know.
I remember you describing for us what it was like to paint with light waves in, I've forgotten the name of the painting program.
And now it's just sort of, you know, a default, you know, program that you can get, you know, that's easy. But that was a thing. That was my first sense of, you know, using one of the first examples of six degrees of you know, freedom, and having that, you know, playing Tilt Brush in there and just remembering being in a space that felt real. Because once you moved your head around, that was what I was, you know, like telling you guys, like, oh, my God,
yeah,
it's amazing. You know, the bartender, you know, when she steps up, you know, the Silicon Valley. But, you know, yeah. And that's the thing, like, we're at a great point now, a great starting point. And the $299 price point, I think, is fantastic.
Yeah. And it also reduces that pain point of upgrading where it's just like, I'll do that.
Yeah. So they unveiled some other stuff too. And one of the things they demonstrated was the concept of the infinite office. And one of the things that they do now with the Quest is you can have your home environment actually be your actual environment, where you'll see in black and white your environment around you and then your interface, et cetera. And then the Quest infinite office, we're watching a video right now where a woman's sitting at a table and she's using her hands to control a screen in front of her. She's scrolling through, like, some web pages, looking at some stuff. She's getting a phone call or you know, she's getting a notification through the, you know, through their telling or something while her roommate's making a lot of noise. She's just like, all right, I'm going to the other room makes a kind of an angry face. Now she's standing at a standing desk and she's looking at different screens and scrolling through stuff. And the background is her actual environment. But, you know, the cameras are black and white, so it's shown as black and white. This is the cool part. She's in VR and she's just pulled out a keyboard. And she's changed her environment to something more serene. And she's got ghost hands. Now she's typing on the keyboard, answering texts.
On a physical keyboard?
Physical keyboard.
Okay.
Yeah. So this is their AR play, right?
Sort of. I mean, she's not an AR right now, but what this is there's Logitech has a keyboard they're partnering with Oculus on that when you pull it into your VR environment, you'll see the keyboard in your VR to be positioned in VR. And then when you just use your hands, whatever, you can see your hands where they are and you can type on the keyboard. Now she's
so
in AR.
And I understand that these terms have very specific definitions, but I guess this would be more what mixed reality,
the idea blended that, reality
like, you have is it blended reality, yeah. not augmented yeah, reality.
I think the thing I was trying to draw attention to is the fact the use of the physical keyboard in VR, the idea that she actually has a full keyboard in there in this office where she can pull up as many screens as she want and has, you know, presumably this sort of environment where all of a sudden she's, you know, pulling out a keyboard, using a keyboard that exists virtually as well as physically.
Yeah. That's huge. The idea that you can go one for one like that. I think there's, you know, I would be in a way it almost kind of feels future focused on like, you know, I work in this great, amazing office and look at all these amazing brass fixtures. And then you take off your
dirty laundry. I don't see any dirty laundry. Oh,
yeah. but I think for somebody that is, I mean, look, work from home has never been more of a big issue as it is right now. The idea of spicing it up in a way that could actually make you more productive and bringing your immersion to a productivity place that's a fascinating idea.
Yeah. So, you know, we'll see where this is going to go towards the future, but you've seen companies now like Spatial. I don't know if you're familiar with them, but like they've got, they're doing these sort of meeting spaces and environments where you can hop in on your Oculus Quest and be there virtually. Somebody can be there on their phone, and they've got their avatars are a little scary because they're using like photo renders onto people and they have these sort of weird hunched shoulders. But you know, we're watching people, you know, virtual ghost people interacting in 3D space while some person's physically standing there.
I think
I don't know if I like this one as much as I like the other idea. Well, the other idea seems a little bit more doable, whereas like this very much seems like an idea dreamed up by people who liked Second Life.
Yes. Well, and I actually think this can work, but nobody will choose to look at like the dead-eyed version of themselves. Everybody's going to be dinosaurs and robots and penguins and Abraham Lincolns and whatever.
Or, you look at the Facebook avatars are pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, I can see that there is an idea of business avatar, right? Because this is, you know, like, all right, you're meeting with your team and you've never met each other before, so maybe this isn't the time to put on the Velociraptor hat. But I think that there are ways that we like to connect right now, and like if immersion is the point, then even at the cost of like seeing another avatar that would collaborate, like that avatar can just as easily be a floating window or text or whatever, as opposed to interacting with
a fidelity problem in that there's still, even in this demo that we're watching right now, there's a certain amount of herky-jerky jitter to everything. And it's like, if I am interviewing somebody for a job or want to know how good of a host they'll be for my corporate retreat or whatever, like, I think I would still prefer just a straight up video shot of them, because I would feel more like I'm seeing the real person than the kind of, representation.
But let me throw out the pro and con, though. Like, I spent like a week or so ago, I had a buddy that was wanted to test something he built in Rec Room, and I spent an hour just talking to him in Rec Room, and we're both just casually sitting, looking at our little silly Rec Room avatars, and it's adapted, and it was better than a phone call. It was better than a phone call, you know, and the advantage of like avatars is if you want to do some sort of video presence, but like you don't want to worry if your hair is combed or put on pajamas and stuff or whatever, you know, a lot of people, it's stressful. A lot of people, video calls are actually stressful because they don't have low standards like we do.
No. I do think that there's a room for virtualized avatars like that. I guess I fell in love with that initial idea of like, oh no, here is just when now you, the archaic thing is what I'm looking at now with my three monitor array. When I really think about like what I'm getting out of it, like if what I need is an ability to connect a internet enabled thing where I can bring up browsers and use certain apps, then yeah, a lot of that can be done. That can all be done on my phone. So it can certainly be done in a heads up display that now I can free up space. I can now just have a standing desk and a couple nice chairs as opposed to an entire room of equipment.
I want to get a little abstract thinking for a moment. And one of my frustrations though with some VR experiences is like, you watch these videos and you look at Horizon, the video for that, and it's these wide open plazas and vistas and people going from here and fro and whatnot. And then other places where you create these big worlds, and then all of a sudden you're down in the middle of it playing it, and you're like, okay, I got to use my thumbstick, or I got to teleport, or in some other fantasy, I'm on a treadmill going from point A to point B. And I wonder if we need to rethink how certain spaces work, because, you know, is there something, should we shrink these spaces? Should we make these spaces smaller so you're not like spending so much time moving from point A to point B?
I could imagine that this would be a place where things could really sing for just the deviceless interface. Like if essentially, you know, much like we have learned certain gestures operate our iPhones, and you have to, there's a learning curve to get at them, and, you know, to, you know, force touch when that was a thing, or to hold touch, or that kind of thing. I could totally see learning a few gestures to move yourself where it's like, maybe you grab a thing, you pull it out, and then you push forward. And then based on how far you push forward is how fast you go. So then all of a sudden you're because it's the clumsiness of the, jump forward, jump forward, jump forward, jump forward, herky jerk left, herky jerk left, herky jerk left, jump forward, jump forward, jump forward. That's a pain in the butt. And I feel like there might be a more analog feeling solution to that.
I'm sure there's like, and that's, it's interesting. It's like some of the people doing academic VR research, like locomotion is like a big area of study. And if you're like, you know, if you're somebody who's looking to get into like computer science, a young audience out there in VR, like go read papers on that. And you realize, oh, wow, you could probably come up with areas to go explore in that field because it's an open problem. I'm wondering like kind of more abstract, like literally shrinking in the space, because that way, should we build interesting 6x6 spaces that feel expansive and big and whatnot? Or do we think about some sort of fourth dimensional form of travel? You know, some, and I don't know what that is, but some idea of like, you know, I know how to move from where I want to move to where to get from point A to point B in some other way. And maybe it's like you said, some sort of gesture thing that feels intuitive or something, but just the idea of, I look at, that's one of the things that holds me back, because you're in this environment, it's great, and it's like, okay, now I'm going to go here. Or even just teleporting. Teleporting's smooth, but I'm like, why do I have to press a button?
But I think it's the aiming and the triggering to teleporting that feels odd, that you're like, now I'm like kind of betting. It's really not, it's like throwing yourself, right? And you're kind of like betting on the arc being exactly right, as opposed to just sort of moving to where you want. I think if that were frictionless, that would be ideal.
And I could totally see like there maybe being a benefit to, maybe there is an outside and an inside. An inside is a bunch of like you said, 6x6 cells that you, conference rooms basically. And then they can all be beautifully themed and they can all look different ways, but essentially they're close. And then when you want to leave, you do a gesture, just making this up, of just your arms go out and you flap once, and then right, and then then you, everything becomes just a bunch of cells in front of you, and you could just point to one and go in another one, or you could just be outside, whatever outside means. I think you're right. I think that, that there's something to the idea of intimacy, of knowing that you are, quote unquote, alone in a room together, as opposed to running around. And that's one of the problems that we see with some of the VR chat programs is that, you know, there's always people running around asking if you know the way.
Yeah. So it's, again, I think it's one of those things. It's just it, you, the difference between you watch those videos like, oh, it feels cool. Would it be cool? Like, yeah, it'd be cool if we were in, you know, gymnasiums and could walk around as much as we wanted and explore. But when we're, you know, 6 by 6 foot spaces, you know, we're, if we're going to do it from home, then we need to think. And then, you know, the other option, though, too, is like once you go fully wireless. And I think the other part is like being able to map your environment around. I think we've shown before some incredible, we've talked about this before, and I've done this, you've done demos of this when it was, you know, early stages, is the VR that will convince you in a much larger space. You know, you start walking.
Right. Where as you turn, it overturns, so you don't really recognize that you're walking in circles across your room, that kind of
thing. Yeah, you hop into an elevator, and then, you know, the next thing you know, you're on another floor, and you feel like you're on another floor, but it's just literally, you just walked into your corner, and you're, no, all right, let's go. Right. So, that'd be fun to see. And I think that's going to be what'll be really exciting now that we have a much more powerful wireless headset. I think we're going to get more developers excited to explore those kinds of things, to think about like how do we make this even more realistic? And it may not be a hardware problem. It may just be a conceptual thing. You know.
Well, I've got a conceptual thing for you. Do you like this show? Would you like to see it keep going? Well, you can head on over to patreon.com/weirdthings. Make sure that this here program continues rolling down the weird road. Patreon.com/weirdthings is where you can get your custom RSS feed, get our After Things podcast, where we talk about all things entrepreneurship and stuff that's going on in our lives. It's right there for you. Patreon.com/weirdthings.
Yeah. I just want to answer a question just posed, because some other people might be asking the same thing. And somebody asked, why not just use a joystick to move? In your VR set controllers, you generally have thumbsticks, which you use to move. And the idea is to get away from that level of abstraction to something that feels more natural, so you feel like you're in the environment and not manipulating a character in the environment.
Man, so. imagine if, how about this? One of the things that you don't get with VR is the sensation. Part of the reason it's creepy to move around in VR is because you see yourself moving. But that's it. But if we were doing kind of a flying thing, you know, you do a gesture and then you push your hand forward and then you start moving. I wonder if something as simple as like a set of fans that would blow air around you as you, you know, and the faster you were going, mm-hmm. the more the air blew on you, would give you that little visual cue that would allow you to feel like a physical presence there.
Yeah, there was a demo a while ago they did where you laid down and they had the fans blow at you like a flying simulator kind of thing, mm-hmm. which, you know, seemed to add to the intensity. Maybe, you know, I just wonder if it's just as simple as a little coding hack or something. Cause like, you know, an interesting thing in video games was, you know, our generation started with joysticks, you know, the big physical sticks. And then all of a sudden Nintendo came out with these dinky kind of controllers, but that became the norm. You know, the controller today is buttons, because it's just where the buttons are, what the buttons work. And, you know, you kind of reach this sort of the sort of high point of, let's say, like the Xbox controller. And for that kind of thing, it just works. And I think with VR, we're still trying to figure that out.
Yeah.
Gentlemen, we've talked about this before, and I think it's interesting because it has a lot of potential of how we travel via air. And that is the Celera 500L, which is a company by Otto Aviation, which has been pretty secretive about this, but they've been working on an aircraft that is designed to be ridiculously fuel efficient. This thing can go 450 miles an hour while only burning like 1 gallon for every 18 to 25 miles, which for an airplane is insane.
What?
And yeah, and like that's like a 10x sort of improvement on what planes can do. And they say the operating cost of this thing is $328 per hour, which if you're with aircraft or something that can hold multiple passengers, that's crazy.
So, okay. So obviously there's environmental aspects to this, but I'm thinking immediately of the cost of air travel side of things, where all of a sudden you could get anywhere. Like, airlines operate on these razor thin margins, partly because just it's so expensive on the fuel side of things. And so when there's a winner, it's usually because they've purchased gasoline futures at a beneficial rate. Mm-hmm. That's how Southwest did really, really well in the early 2000s. But if you just didn't need that much fuel, what's the secret to it? Is it like half helium or something?
Hogwarts. just side note, but like, because air travel, because nobody's flying, they're actually blending aircraft fuel to use in ships right now. Like, that's how, like, you know, how impacted that industry's been. But the secret is several things. If you look at the body, the fuselage of it, it's a radically different sort of shape and design. It's supposed to be extremely efficient. They were early versions were using a diesel engine, which I don't know if that's still the case for that, which people are like, diesel, what? That sounds crazy. Like, aircraft, there's been a lot of things that always surprised me what's capable of that. So it's got, you know, basically just a number of things from redesigned engine. There's some sort of like I think regenerative like systems they're using. A lot of improvements that have existed elsewhere, but as far as like how they've been put together, they say 1,500 horsepower diesel engine. The prototype's done 31 flights, and they say they expect FAA certification in 2023 with service in 2025.
So here's the other crazy part is the range is so much farther on it because it's so efficient. Then that means imagine like, yeah, even if you're going slower than a commercial airliner at, you know, 550 or 600 miles or however many miles an hour, you're skipping the whole hour-long layovers and going straight to the place.
Yeah, you're in, you know, 460 miles an hour is, you know, for smaller aircraft, you know, or like charter stuff is fine. You know, so I mean that's, you know, you're, you know, and like what we've known, we talk about, like we've flown on like JetX before and stuff, how just being able to show up 20 minutes before your plane leaves is magical.
Yeah.
Magical.
Oh no. Yeah. Just a huge. So I guess the question is, do they get into the world where they're selling these things, or are they going to run their own service and build their own fleet?
I believe they're probably going to sell. And then basically, you know, I think that's going to be the best market.
Somebody will base their airline on this.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, you get the idea that part of the advantage of this is that there are way more airports than people realize. Most people realize that is that if you look at a map, you realize that like, oh, wow, there's a little executive airport here. There's an airport here. And you can't put 727s on those runways, but you can put much smaller craft. And a lot of that serves, you know, there is an entire world of aviation outside of people getting on big jets, you know, from private aircraft that serve, you know, functions for, you know, transporting documents, things like this, certain other kinds of flights, and opening up those airfields to, that's been a dream for decades of trying to come up, you know, fuel efficient aircraft that make it easier so you could do, you know, smaller airlines and, you know, air taxi sort of service.
So let's just assume that in general, the nearest major airport is, let's say, a half hour to 1.5 hours away from most people. So you cut out, that goes down to 15 minutes. Most people are probably less than 15 to 20 minutes away from a small executive airfield. Mm-hmm. On top of that, you're also cutting out the transfer point in the middle. The trade-off is you're going a little bit slower, but this is some of that alchemy stuff where it's just like, if effectively, like somehow going slower will make your trip faster or at least feel much, much faster.
Yeah, you think about if it's $388 per flight hour and whatnot, and you're paying, you know, you put six passengers in there and you're paying, you know, $200 or $300 a piece or whatever. I mean, there's a viable business model there. You know, it's really you figure out your fuel costs, your pilot costs, your ground support costs, and I think we may see.
Also, no TSA. I just realized as well, because it would be a private airline.
Yeah, so you'd have whatever private sort of system they want. And so, yeah, I think that I'm excited about this form of travel, because I think that I don't travel as much as I do because I do not like airports. I do not like the hassle. That's the bottom line, is that there's few places that are worth getting to that are worth spending half a day going through that aggravation. Were, you know, it is easy as the times that I've been able to fly on charter and fly on other kinds of flight like that, then I would do it. You know, were that more economically feasible for me, I would do that more often. I'm willing to pay more, you know, to do that. And I think a lot of us would be.
Yeah. I mean, any way that you can shake up that industry, I think it's going to be beneficial for everybody. And part of it is also like, we're at an inflection point for a lot of different things, and air travel is certainly among them, to ask like, okay, well, what's the norm, right? You know, the new United CEO just came in and said like, oh, by the way, no more change fees. Like, we're getting rid of them because they got to figure out what air travel is going forward. And I almost wish technology like this were a year closer to being viable or getting FAA certified, because I kind of feel like, well, you know, six people instead of, you know, 100, like, yeah, that might meet the moment.
There's, you know, something we've talked about this before, but I don't think we've had this conversation kind of in the context where we are now. And that one of the things that we often, when you think about travel in the future, we usually think about, you know, rockets, you know, things like this, you know, SpaceX or et cetera. We often think about maybe fancier looking airplanes, but moving to, you know, a model where you have, you know, we've seen Uber's shift has been kind of a bit from the self-driving car to more like, no, we want to have, you know, flying cars that take you from city centers to outer limits, et cetera. Because, you know, that's, you know, the tragic accident with Kobe Bryant and everybody else on that helicopter flight, you know, his daughter and the rest of the passengers in there, you know, kind of illustrated this thing that a lot of people weren't aware of, was like, how many times a helicopter flies overhead, and it's somebody who can afford, that means to travel. You know, it's not just somebody doing important helicopter stuff. No, it's a form of travel that's used to get from point A to point B. But a trend is often what the rich people are doing now, 20 to 30 years from now, everybody's going to do. You know, we used to laugh at those rich people with their car phones. You know, look at those jerks with their brick phones, those Gordon Geckos and stuff. Well, now we all have them. And the same thing applies to travel. And so it is a very interesting thing to think about. Like, if for longer distance travel, if we don't have to travel because we're used to working from home, then you got to make it better.
Yeah.
And maybe we're willing to pay more.
Yeah, well, especially, that gets easier to deal with if you're doing it less. You know, it's like when I was on tour, it was just the cost of doing business. And if I was going to make money on this magic show, I had to fly at the lowest rate possible. And that meant flying a lot of crummy airlines and having miserable experiences. But there was no way to do a magic show without showing up. And now... Now we got all these people who are doing exactly that.
Yeah, and you could think too about a model where one of the things that happened, which was interesting, was a lot of people who own jets, they actually own, you know, fractional jet ownership. You know, the idea is that if you're a fancy person and you want to travel as a fancy person does, then you want to have your own airplane. But you don't really want to own an airplane, because owning an airplane means you have to figure out, like, have to have a pilot, you have to have a hangar, you have to have all these other things. And fractional jet ownership came along, which was basically you pay $30,000 a month or something like this, and you're guaranteed, you know, 30 hours of flight time per month or something like that, which meant that you just say, and you could have a certain amount of availability window. You could say, oh, I just need to be able to have this in the next couple hours or tomorrow or whatever. Which was a way to sort of basically, because they figured out, like, man, most of these people have jets, they sit idle, they're not being used. And so if you say, okay, we can have 10 jets service, you know, 80 clients, then they save, we make a profit off of the fact that we have that availability. You start extending that model into, like, when you say, you know, Brian, like, I need to get from Austin to Los Angeles to come hang out with my buddy Andrew. I want a guaranteed ticket from here to there. It just, and with some, a carrier or whoever meets the minimum star rating that I want, all I care is that when I show up at the little airport, you know, on Friday at 2 p.m., something is there.
Yeah.
Waiting to take me
there. Yeah.
And that gets to be an interesting sort of way of saying, like, yeah, like buying travel, not buying airlines, not buying, you know, anything else.
Yeah, the most of the options, let's take Austin to LA as an example. Most of the options are going to be 6 to 7 hour journeys, because you'll have to stop in Phoenix or Las Vegas or something like that. Plus, you'll have, let's say, conservatively an hour long TSA. You have to get there beforehand. Then you got to wait for your luggage. Call that a half an hour afterwards. So I don't think it's unreasonable to say it's like a 7.5 experience. If you're very, very lucky, you get a direct flight, and that's 3.5 hours plus the TSA and the luggage experience. So that makes it, what, 5 hours. You can go a lot slower and have a lot more comfortable experience for a little bit more money if you just went straight point to point.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's going to be an interesting thing, is rethinking the entire travel grid from autonomous driving, which, again, it's going to take a while. There's the edge cases are hard, but also, you know, flying cars, et cetera. And just, you know, you guys watch Westworld season 3.
Yep.
Part of what I loved, though, was like kind of the flying car kind of thing. You just walked up, hopped into this thing. It took you off, whisked you away to wherever you needed to be. And then you were somewhere else. You know, that vision of the thing of, you know, just transportation becoming a thing you don't even think about. You know, you just say, I got to get from here to there. And somebody says, oh, go hop into this thing. I'm in this thing. You're like, and I want private. I'm a fancy person. I want to be private all the way. No problem. And right. Then boom, from here to here to here.
Well, and then once you really start thinking about that stuff, then you start to say, well, how much do I even care about taking my bags with me? If, you know, if a company knows my measurements and I know that it will have clothing of a style that I like, and you know, deodorants of my favorite, you know, preferences or whatever. I'll just hop into a thing, and my body will be there, and you know, some version of clothing that I like that'll be clean will be ready to go.
Yeah, is there a Target near my hotel? That's all I need to know.
but if you like, but I don't even care if it's used clothing. I mean, I buy stuff from thrift stores all the time. So it's like, as long as it's clean and matches, you know, a fashion sensibility that I like. Whatever.
Welcome to Dude Travel Talk.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't care. Whatever. Overalls. It's fine by me.
I wash my hair with bar soap.
Yeah. I do think there is something, in fact, that like I am lazy. You know, the point that like, I think almost all my clothes come from Amazon, and I could certainly see, like, I could just show up at a hotel and open up a cardboard box and it's, yes, it's my wardrobe and everything I use. And then I'm done. I close it into the box. Don't know what happens to it.
Don't care. You hop onto the thing and off you go again.
It'll still be cheaper than the Pepsi from the hotel minibar.
Yeah.
And tastes better.
It tastes better.
You guys want to jump into picks?
Yeah, man.
Sure.
I saw a sprawling time travel odyssey over this last weekend.
Uh-huh.
Bill and Ted Face the Music.
Hmm.
I liked it.
Cool. I want to see that. I'm looking forward to it.
It was exactly what it's exactly what you expect. It's exactly what I expected. I had a really good time. There was a couple of clever things that they did. It was fun.
Cool.
Yeah. I think it's just charming. You know, you just get to like, you get these great, you know, your face hurts from smiling kind of moments, which is, I think, ultimately what that series has kind of delivered, consistently.
They also deliver a new type of character that I don't think I've ever seen anywhere else, in the form of Justin probably knows who I'm talking about.
No, they
I liked him quite a bit.
I think that that's another hallmark of the series. It's just these great against type characters. You know, that continues. Cool. All right. My pick. I like Lovecraft Country. I don't know. Where do we want to talk? Did you guys watch The Vow? Are we here for Vow chat?
I tried to watch the latest episode.
Latest episode. Yeah, let's talk. Let's talk about The Vow.
I'm just really glad that NXIVM is the Roman numeral a number to signify how many episodes are unnecessary in this season. Because good God, could they cut this thing down? Like, between the episode before this, this episode, and then what they tease in the episode that's happening next week, boy, is that one story. Would that be a good hour?
Will you forgive me? Like, I watched it, and for the life of me, I don't think if there was money on the table, I would be able to remember what last night's episode was about.
So things that happened. Number one, I think one of the most legitimate criticisms of the series, for which Andrew has brought up, and I certainly second, the idea that, like, hey, let's not pretend that all the negative press about Nixium popped up in like 2017. This is something that had been around for a while. They go into that. I don't know if it's quite a reckoning for our protagonist in the way that maybe it would be if things were you know, being done another different way. But like, beyond that, it's just, there's good stuff. They always have a little nugget of a thing that's like, oh, have you ever wondered what happens when the Dalai Lama meets a ne'er-do-well? Here you go. Like, we see video from inside this conversation. But man, would that also be better in an episode that moved? And boy, howdy, is there just yet more keeping up with the Kardashian style recreations of things that, like, you don't really even get the sense of, like, when you are in time, because the last time we left these characters, our Vancouver lady was in LA with this family, and then we don't know, like, was it a week? Has it been 2 weeks? Why is she back in Vancouver? Like, either we're gonna create urgency here as you're trying to pretend that this is all contemporary, or you're not, but boy,
I believe the whole Dalai Lama arc was, we found out we were gonna get the Dalai Lama, but then we almost didn't get the Dalai Lama, but then we got the Dalai Lama. like that was the story. Minutes of the episode. No,
well, they're like, the Dalai Lama is going to come to Albany. And then they're like, and then somebody amongst his holiness Googles, and they're like, whoa, oh my God, have you read about this guy? This guy is awful. And they're like, no, absolutely not. I don't care. No.
But, hey, are you awful? No, I'm not.
Well,
awful.
No. Then they're like, oh, well, he's going to fly to Tibet or wherever the Dalai Lama lives, or in India. And he's like, okay. Well, he showed up, and the Dalai Lama is like, I don't know. It seems like you're awful. And he's like, all lies, Dolly. And he's like, for real? And he's like, bro. And they're like, I mean, people tell lies about me. Let's get back on the flight and leave. And it's like, there's an element of that that's like really funny, but it's like, but at the end of the day, the more interesting version of this story is looking at things in a way different way. And there's like, there are elements of this that are just startlingly tone deaf. Like, all of our main characters are just driving around in luxury vehicles. Like, they're all in Benzes and BMWs. Oh,
Malibu home, yeah. Homes in Malibu. Yeah.
Malibu homes. So, and it's like, they're all just like, oh, I'm so sad. I'm very sad right now. Oh,
Can I give you like my take on it? I sort of summarized this in a tweet because like I've been following this story for years, right? Of next year. I mean, I'm fascinated by cults for purely, you know, research purposes. And it really hit me like this is for me, anybody who's followed the story for a while, it's like you're watching, like, oh, you gotta check out this HBO show. You know, what's it about? Oh, it's about this woman who begins to suspect her husband has a dark side. Oh, cool. And you watch this thing, it's like, yeah. You know, his letters to me, things like this, I'm beginning to realize that, yeah, there may be some darker side to him and maybe I need to get out of a relationship. Well, what's his name? Oh, Ted Bundy. He's my prison pen pal. Wait. So this relationship started after he was in jail for doing this. And then you realized he maybe had a dark. And that was like this. It's like Google this dude. If you Google this dude years ago, you would see before this, we begin to suspect. It's out there. It was out there. It was like, yeah, I'm beginning to suspect this cult leader with allegations of child abuse, manipulation, extortion, fraud, might have a dark side.
Well, yeah. And they just blast by these things where it's just like, oh, yeah. One of the accusations was that he molested or like had like, you know, statutory raped this girl that was a part of it. Moving on. Turns out the New York Times wants to do a story. And it's like,
well,
look,
they can only
I'm
do it
here.
If we all pinky promise at the same time.
Which, look. There's another version. I don't know if this is the story that you want to tell with it. This is like a half episodes thing where you tell the entire version of what it's like to put together a story like this. I do think that there is a very real element of like, okay, for these stories, do you go on the record? Do you not go on the record? I think that there's compelling reasons that you can debate whether or not the story will run, the consequences for it. Like, I think that's interesting. Good God, it does not need to be an episode and a half, which is apparently what they're going to do, because surprise at the end, the big hook is like, we interview the New York Times reporter.
Ooh.
Come back next. Yeah, exactly. Come back next week.
I think I'm a little bit more forgiving of this aspect of everything in that I'm the target demographic and that I am totally ignorant of the full story. This was all news to me. I didn't read the articles about it. I didn't know about it. I only knew that you guys knew about it by osmosis. And even in that position, I agree with your criticisms.
Yeah. It's not the way in which you want to tell. It's just we're given a narrative that I'm having trouble understanding. Like that does not reconcile with my understanding of the facts and points of views of characters. They're like, wait, this was known here, and you haven't addressed this. Like it's just made this like, I don't know, Ted Bundy. You know, like it's, you know, it's like you're like, wait, like didn't how are we? Why are we not talking about this? And it's like, oh,
I mean,
because
we get,
the documentary
we get,
series.
No, I mean, we get some of that in this episode. Like you okay. At least get questions to the main people. On like, why did you ignore so much bad press? And you get the standard cult answer of, well, you know, we just assumed that these people were out to get us and there was always a reason why. And he always had an answer and blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
Now, I think in another version of this documentary, I don't know if he would be taken at his word there. I think there would probably be an uncomfortable moment where they are asked repeatedly, but why, but why, but why? And they would have to squirm a little bit more. But at least it is like out there that beyond the Frank report, which like is another a pivot point on why they're innocent, because they're like, oh, it's only this blog that's writing about it. They at least refer to, hey, there was a gigantic series by the Times Union. There was a lot of other information out there, and they called him a cult leader. They called him a molester. They called him an abuser. So it's like you do have to at least on some level answer for it in this episode. But even then, it's like, okay, well, where do we go from here? And also, I found this out. This some bitch is 9 episodes. We're just over the halfway mark of this story. And I'm like, I think there's a lot here, but good God, does it not need to be 9 episodes? It could have been a killer 5 episodes.
Yeah.
I gotta make it through, because that we talked that before, because you'd asked me would I be more forgiving if they kind of reconciled, that they brought up that question of like, were they confronted with what was known before? So I need to finish, but oh man, like I'm like 5 minutes in, and the reenactment stuff that's not acknowledged reenactment was driving me nuts.
They at least acknowledge, they like very briefly, they have the word reenactment in there.
No,
on this one.
On one thing.
Right.
On one thing that isn't them acting.
Right.
It's another thing of women talking about things that have happened in the cult, and they just have voice actors, but they didn't have a reenactment thing when they literally had a woman that was voice acted and body acted by somebody else before.
I was dialed in a little bit more, and I believe this episode, as bad as it is on the reenactment and the timeline stuff, might be the most precise they've been yet, which is horrifying because I saw like five dates given and the word reenactment once.
Yes, exactly.
And that's better than they've done the entire series beforehand.
Yeah, and a lot of it's like, yo, this is 10 years. Like, when they're talking about all of the previous, like, the Times Union articles and everything, like, they're talking about 03, 04, 05, 06. Like, so, yeah, it's an interesting series. I think that there is a very compelling story there, but...
We're not going to be able to stop watching, are we? We're going to.
No, now it's to a point where I have to keep watching it now, because I'm rooting for Keith Raniere to win.
God. Yeah. In our chat, somebody says, all I know is L.A. sex cult and Superman actress. So Albany, New York, Vancouver.
Yeah.
There and sex cult. Not all of it. And then. Yeah, the Smallville actress.
Yeah.
And then who?
Yeah, no, here's
also half the cast of Battlestar Galactica.
Yeah, here's what I've learned. Like, if you like The Expanse, just write the actors a note on Twitter. Just, I like you, and you're worth it. And please, just, man, it seems like all these sci-fi actors that were shooting in Vancouver had some self-esteem problems that they all just got hoovered up into this funnel.
You don't need to seek validation from anyone but me.
You're great. I just, apropos of nothing, the universe believes you to be great.
Bryce, you have a pick?
I do have a pick. This came out a few weeks ago, and I finally got a chance to dive into it. I did not have, let's say, the same exposure to this that a lot of other people did, but I'm really enjoying it, and I'm told it's a very faithful recreation. It is the new Tony Hawk's Pro Skater 1 Plus 2. They went and they remade those games.
Oh.
And they put them in one package. And it's pretty good. It is really good. You look at Tony Hawk's Pro Skater 5, which came out a couple years ago, and that game sunk on ice. It took forever to load. The physics were bad. It had this forced online lobby system for everything. This has got none of that. This is Vicarious Visions, who made the Crash Bandicoot remake last year or the year before, which was also really, really good. I'm really digging this. It's easy to jump in. It loads really quick, like, because there's a lot of like, oh, I messed this up, I'm going to restart. That doesn't take forever. So they've remade all of the levels. They've got all of the skaters plus new skaters. They've got all the tricks. I think the only like big fundamental difference between these is the Tony Hawk Skater 1 levels, you can also do the manuals and the reverts. So all the stuff where you could chain your combos on the ground from that they added to Tony Hawk 2 is also available in Tony Hawk 1, which makes some of those levels a little easier. But I really dig it. And it's $40, which is like a really good price for both of those games. They've added a lot of challenges into the game. So, hey, as Tony Hawk, do all of Tony Hawk's specials, get these stat boosts, get a medal in the competitions, you know? So those are meant to add in extra longevity. There's online multiplayer. There's an interesting speed run mode now. So when you complete all of the goals in a level, instead of starting a 2 minute timer counting down, it starts a stopwatch counting up, and it sees how long it takes you to finish all of the goals in that level. As fast as you can, which is fun. It's like there are a lot of like little bits like that make it feel very modern. And I really dig it. I am also not very good at this game. A lot of people are very good at Tony Hawk. I am All right.
Man, I would love it if they did this for the original SSX. I would play the hell out of that.
Hmm.
Oh, my pick is Raised by Wolves.
Oh, how are you liking that?
I'm enjoying the heck out of it. Anybody else watching this?
Mm-mm.
No, but I've heard it's good. That's on Peacock, right?
No, Bryce. It is not on Peacock. It is on HBO Max.
Oh, I
see. Okay, because there's nothing on Peacock right now. Nothing.
Wow.
I don't know. Maybe there is. Maybe there's a lot of great stuff. Raised by Wolves is a science fiction series produced, and the first several episodes are directed by Ridley Scott.
And oh, wow. How do I not know about this?
I thought you knew. I just assumed. And the premise, if you watch the trailer, you think, oh, it's about this. It's not. And there's this conflict where eventually there's a new planet, and the first people we send to colonize it, or first ones to get sent to colonize it, is a man and woman android and six embryos that they raise as these children. And then the conflict starts to happen because they're fleeing a war on Earth, and then the other side shows up. And I do not want to spoil anything about this. So I would just say that, like, I am going to do mild spoilers. So close your ears. If you watch the trailers, but it's just a first act, you know, like first episode sort of thing. I'm like, I was into it. And then when the space crusaders showed up, I was really into it. You know, when the religious zealots showed up dressed like, you know, space crusaders, I'm like, oh, now I'm into this.
Wow. Right on. No, that sounds awesome.
I'm told it's very Ridley Scott.
Yeah, but and good Ridley Scott. Like, this is, to me, is like Ridley Scott on a canvas of television exploring a lot of themes and stuff. And that's where the world just opened up for me, because it becomes about different viewpoints and different factions and stuff, survival, etc. I think it's my favorite thing Ridley Scott's done in a while. And I don't want to oversell it, but it's weird. It's good, weird sci-fi, because you watch the trailer and it feels like just like a sci-fi channel movie of like, oh, these robots on a planet trying to kill a person. Like, it's deeper.
Cool.
Very awesome. Cool.
So, yeah, Raised by Wolves, HBO Max. Check it out. I would love to talk about it with other people. And again, like I said, it's just not, because I turned to my girlfriend and watched it. I like this because it's not like anything else.
Yeah.
All right, gentlemen, it's been weird.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.